Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. We're talking about his latest book, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
This book was like being shot out of a cannon over space and time.
Yeah.
I mean,
it does cover some ground.
You think? It's like, Here you have material that starts with like Big Bang, the formation of the universe, human consciousness, creativity, the function of religion, all the way through to the end of the universe, and actually after the end of the universe as we know it.
Right.
Is there some event that brought this about? And yeah, I mean, it's almost like you had some kind of epiphany, or if you're a theoretical physicist, that you sort of end up always wanting to write this kind of book.
Yeah, it's more the latter. You know, I've been doing theoretical physics research for now 35 or so years, and to me, it was always not solely about trying to figure out this mathematical equation or develop this theory of the origin of the universe or things of that sort. While that was always an important motivation and immediate target of the research, it always felt to me that the undertaking was really about figuring out how we humans fit into the largest possible picture, you know, the one that begins at the beginning and ends at the end. And so I've been thinking about these ideas for a very long time, and it felt like a good moment to set down decades of thinking about my take on that question, how we do fit into the big picture.
What was surprising to me is how far into the distant future you brought this book. You brought it further than any other book I've covered on this show.
What was
it like to contemplate the really distant future? I mean, it for me, that was the most enjoyable part of the book.
Yeah, you know, for me, it has a curious effect, one that, as I describe in the book, has certainly changed for me over time. Early on, when I began to think about things that are so far into the future that the time from the Big Bang until today is just an instant by comparison, you know, that certainly had a kind of shuddering effect on me, the kind of thing that makes you go into a slight cold sweat, you know, things of that sort. But in time, after thinking about these ideas, and what I try to communicate in the book, is that it allows one a real sense of connection, a feeling in some sense of a communion with this larger cosmic unfolding of which our era is a tiny but important piece. So for now, it kind of fills me with a sense of gratitude for being here at all. And I think that was what I would like people to take away from the experience of journeying that far into this distant future.
It's amazing because the book really does have an arc and an ending. And you don't usually get that out of physics books. There is a summation of like, okay, now that we know this or we're postulating a lot of this, what does that mean for our life now? I love the fact that you quoted Annie Hall and Alvy Singer, the young Alvy Singer in this book.
Yeah.
You know, like he's not going to do his homework anymore because he knows that the universe is all just going to fall apart. And that seems flip, but it's an important question.
Yeah, it is a real question. And, you know, in Annie Hall, of course, you know, Albie's mother and the psychiatrist are just at a loss for why Albie would care about what's going to happen, you know, 5 billion years into the future. And again, as I discuss in the book, you know, at least when I saw the film, I think most audiences, when they see that scene, you know, they laugh because it seems farcical that this little kid is worrying about these big issues that the adults don't seem to care about. But the reality is, I think the reason why the adults don't seem to care about it is because they haven't really thought about it.
That's right.
Or if they have thought about it, they haven't taken in the full gravity of the situation, which is that, you know, human life or life of any sort, or as I describe in the book, even the possibility of thinking beings of any kind whatsoever may have a limited lifespan in the cosmic unfolding. So way back in the beginning, presumably there was no life, no mind, until life emerged at some point. We know when that happened on planet Earth. Perhaps it happened at other times on other worlds. But in the far future, we will revert back to that barren realm when there is no life and there is no mind. Now, we're not absolutely sure about this, and in the book I give arguments, which I think are quite convincing, that this is the future that we are facing. And if you take that in fully, it does command your attention. It does make you wonder about why you should do anything, or why you should do what you do, or why Albie should do his homework. So these are real issues that deserve attention.
Yeah, there's a couple of thought problems you mentioned in the book that people have posed. Which would affect you more, being told you have a year to live, or that in a year, everybody on Earth is gone? The whole Earth is gone. And then there were some variations on that. And it's interesting. Those two questions, those two possible endings, elicit different responses from people.
Yeah, they do. And I think it's a deep realization. And certainly for me, personally, it had a tremendous impact on my own thinking about my own life and my sense of the cosmic unfolding. Because you're right, I think for many people, certainly for me, I can speak personally with absolute certainty, if I were to learn, say, that I was facing mortal disease, that I was going to die in a year, I think it would focus my attention at the moment, on the moment, at the things that I'm doing right now, and it would invest the everyday with a larger sense of meaning, because every moment would count, every moment would be one step closer to annihilation. However, the flip question, the one that you also describe, which is, if I were to learn that everybody, Earth and everything that we hold dear, everything that we have created since the dawn of humankind, if that was all going to be obliterated, say, in a year or something of that sort, it does change your reaction, at least it changes my reaction, because right. It begins to make you wonder, what does any of this mean? Why should I go to work? Why should I write a book? Why should I do research? Why should I do anything at all? Buddy, if there's going to be nobody in the future who is going to be there to receive that wisdom, that knowledge, that work, those insights.
It seems to me that, therefore, that the context of our humanity or individual humanity is important, that we need the others around us to also give our life meaning.
Exactly. You know, we are a deeply social species. It's how we survived. It's why we prevailed, for good or for ill. It's why we're the dominant species on planet Earth. And if we are faced with a situation where there's nobody else, no, perhaps ourselves, but even nobody else who's going to be able to participate in the forward motion of the species, then it's hard to see how there's any purpose or meaning at all.
There are so many ideas in this book. It's sort of ridiculous. We do an hour on every chapter. But one of the important, absolutely essential concepts, theories that emerges every single time, the second law of thermodynamics and entropy. Can you just talk about that for people who don't know about it?
Yeah, that is one of the dominant guiding principles, certainly one I use in the book to guide the discussion, but also one that guides the unfolding of the universe, which is something I think many people are familiar with, at least in name, which is that the amount of order in the universe tends to degrade over time. It tends to decrease over time. So-called entropy, which is a measure of disorder, entropy tends to grow over time. And in rough language, that tells us that things tend to run down. They tend to wither. They tend to fall apart. They tend to decay. And it is a vital principle because as you look around the world, you can see that this is a guiding tendency which allows us to understand a great many physical unfoldings. Why things change from this to that? Well, they did so because that was the orientation that ensured that order decayed. That was the orientation that ensured entropy increased.
But what's the entropic two-step?
Well, that's a less well-known description of a quality of this second law of thermodynamics, which is absolutely vital for understanding how it can be in a universe that's heading toward ever greater disorder. How can it be that ordered structures like stars and planets and galaxies and you and me and all other life on planet Earth, how could it be that such ordered structures emerge if the universe is heading toward greater disorder? And the answer, which is given by the so-called entropic two-step, is a kind of entropic dance. And that dance is, even though the total amount of disorder is increasing over time, you can have pockets of order that pop up so long as the formation of those pockets of order yields an ever greater amount of disorder that they emit to their environment, so that on balance, the total amount of disorder goes up, even though here and there, order can increase. And this is important because stars are orderly structures. But if you look at their formation in detail, you find that when stars form, they always emit through heat and radiation a greater amount of disorder that they spew out to their environment. And on balance, the total amount of disorder goes up even though the star and orderly structure can form. And when stars can form, planets can form by the same entropic two-step. Entropy goes down here, so long as it goes up there, that's the two-step. And life itself, you and I, we dance the entropic two-step every moment of our lives. We take in food, orderly structures. We digest them. We use that order to grow and to maintain our bodily processes. And in the process of that, we emit waste and heat, infrared radiation to the environment that compensates, yielding a more than greater disorder compared to the amount of order that we create internally. So we create order inside, and we dance, emit disorder to the environment. And it's that dance that's the reason why the universe is interesting. Without that, we would have simply gone to greater disorder, and there would simply be particles floating this way and that in the void, and there would be no structure.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. And we're talking about his latest book, Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. Brian, when you, in this last sort of third of the book, when you start to talk about distant times, distant epochs, you use a building, an Empire State Building metaphor, in order to help people grasp how large a time period we're talking about. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, we need to go so far into the future that it strains most any metaphor to give the individual a sense of the time scales that we're talking about. So the Empire State Building is the building I use, at least as an attempt to give a mental toehold for understanding the kind of temporal climb we are undertaking. And the metaphor is simply this. Imagine that each floor of the Empire State Building represents a duration from the Big Bang that's 10 times larger than the previous floor. So floor number one is 10 years from the Big Bang. Floor number two, 100 years. Floor number three, 1,000 years. Floor number four, 10,000 years, and so forth. And that means that as you climb up the Empire State Building, you're heading exponentially far into the future.
And it's amazing. It works. It's a great way to conceive of these times. And I want to talk about some of these ending scenarios. One of them has to do with repulsive gravity, and that's probably something few people have heard of. Was it Alan Guth that came up with the concept? What would happen if repulsive gravity increases?
Yeah, so Alan Guth is one of the pioneers of this idea, but you can really trace it all the way back to the man himself, Albert Einstein, in his general theory of relativity way back in the early parts of the 20th century. Implicit in the equations that Einstein wrote down is the capacity of gravity to do something that we are completely unfamiliar with from everyday life. We know of gravity that pulls things together, and in Einstein's theory, gravity has the capacity to do the opposite, push things apart. And we believe that this is relevant to the universe right now, because when we look at distant galaxies, they are rushing away faster and faster over time. The expansion of the universe that we've known about for 100 years is picking up speed. It's accelerating. And the answer for why that's happening, we believe, is that there is an energy suffusing space that gives rise to this repulsive version of gravity that is pushing everything apart, causing the expansion to speed up over time. And now, relevant to your question, if you climb up the Empire State Building, you go up to floor 10, that's basically where we are today. We're about, 13 billion years since the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang. But if you climb a little bit higher, if you climb roughly to floor 12, if it's the case that this repulsive gravity itself picks up energy, that is, becomes ever more repulsive over time, a long shot possibility, I should emphasize, but one that people certainly consider, then by roughly the 12th floor, all of galaxies will have rushed away so far and so fast that we won't be able to see them. And moreover, even objects like stars, the internal repulsive gravity will blast them apart. And even planets will be blasted apart. And even atoms themselves will be blasted apart by this repulsive push. We call it the Big Rip. And in principle, the universe could have begun with a Big Bang. And the long shot possibility of this repulsive gravity picking up energy and steam over time, it may cause the universe to end in a Big Rip.
What about the idea of proton decay?
That's one that's been on the table.
Yeah, it's been around for a while.
Yeah, I mean, as I described in the book, back when I was a student, an undergraduate student back in the 1980s, my physics advisor at Harvard was Howard Georgi, and he was one of the pioneers with Sheldon Glashow of the idea that protons, which are the heart of matter as we know it, they themselves may have a limited lifespan. They may fall apart. They may blast apart. And if they did, matter itself would disintegrate into finer constituent particles. And this is an idea that comes right out of the mathematics of attempts to unify nature's forces. Georgi and Glashow's scheme was called grand unification, developed in the 1980s. But we have found in almost every attempt to go deeper into the mathematics of nature's laws, the possibility that protons will decay, it just rears up. It's the most natural consequence we find in almost all of our cutting-edge theories. Now, experimentally, and this is important, people have looked for protons decaying, and as yet we have not seen it happen. That's not necessarily surprising because the lifetime of these protons is really long, according to the mathematics. You'd probably have to climb, well, according to Georgi and Glashow's scheme, you'd have to climb to floor 30 of the Empire State Building, 10 to the 30 years into the future, to have a reasonable chance of seeing a single proton decay. Now, you might say, well, then of course you've never seen one decay. The lifetime is too long. But if you look at enough protons, just have a big tank of them, then if they're more than 10 to the 30 protons, you'd expect, well, one of them to decay. It's all statistics. But we haven't seen that. And so we've put limits on the lifetime of a proton. The limit is roughly that their lifetime is at least as long as about 10 to the 34, 10 to the 35 years. You'd have to climb five more floors up the Empire State Building to have a reasonable chance of seeing one decay. And we as yet don't know whether that's correct, but it's compatible with observations, and it emerges from our mathematical studies. So in the book, I take this as a likely possibility that protons themselves will ultimately fall apart, which means that matter itself, everything that we know about, every molecule, every atom, will disintegrate if you wait long enough.
One of the things I really enjoy about your book is that you still try to push somehow that thinking could still be going on. It's like with all this stuff going on, black holes could be evaporating. And there's some really fascinating concepts. What's a Boltzmann brain?
Well, that's a bizarre possibility. But when you consider the enormous timescales that I consider in the book, it's one that deserves attention. And the idea is simply this. Imagine, as the math seems to suggest, that in the very far future, all that you have in the universe is particles floating through the darkness of space. There's no structure around. Everything has disintegrated into the most elementary constituents. Now, you might think that if that's the case, it'll just stay like that for, well, eternity. But eternity is a very long time, and strange things can happen along the way. And the one that I consider, the one you mentioned, Boltzmann brains, is simply this. Particles in the void every so often can collide with each other. And then those particles, every so often can collide with other particles. And on, over a very long period of time, structures rarely, randomly, can coalesce in the void just through the random motion of particles slamming into one another. Among the structures that, in principle, can form is a brain imprinted with all the thoughts and memories of an ordinary human brain. Let's say it's my brain. So my brain is nothing but a collection of particles arranged in a certain configuration, allowing them to have memories of the past and allowing them to cogitate on things that are in the main portion of my brain at the moment. And so if, by chance, particles in the void should happen to randomly come together and reconstruct my brain in its exact quantum state, or to be looser, with all particles in exactly the right location to be an exact replica of my brain at this very moment, then that brain in the void would think it's me. That brain in the void would think it's having this conversation with you. That brain in the void would have all the memories that I do. So it's a weird possibility that if you wait long enough, these Boltzmann brains, as they are called, these brains can simply form in the void, which in some sense is a bizarre and strange resurrection of thought out of the fundamental constituents in the of the universe.
Is there a reasonable chance that the universe could just circle back on itself?
Well, anything that's compatible with the quantum mechanical laws of nature can in principle happen if you wait long enough. So it's easier in some sense to form a brain because it's a fewer number of particles creating a smaller structure. But in principle, you could recreate the whole universe as we know it by particles randomly coalescing to just happen to reproduce everything that we currently are aware of, say, in the observable universe. Another possibility entirely is that you don't recreate the universe, but rather you recreate the conditions that allow a new Big Bang to happen, and then the cosmic unfolding occurs anew in much the same way that it happened 13.8 billion years ago. That's another possibility in principle that could happen if you wait the time scales that we're talking about.
What about the idea of the multiverse?
That's another one of the more speculative ideas of cutting-edge physics, which suggests that the universe that we are familiar with, you know, all the stars and galaxies in the observable universe, that they may actually be a small part of a much grander reality in which there are other realms that themselves should rightly be called universes of their own. So much as we learn, for instance, that the Earth is not the center of the universe because we finally realize that the Earth goes around the sun, and when we finally also learn that the sun is not the center of the universe because the sun is one of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and then we learn that the Milky Way galaxy is not the be-all and end-all of the universe because there are hundreds of billions of other galaxies, we may one day confirm this idea that even our universe is not the be-all and end-all because it is one of many, perhaps infinitely many, other universes that come together to create the multiverse.
We're almost out of time, but I need to pay attention to your sort of summation at the very end of the book. And it's so important because after talking about all these different dooms and possible scenarios for the destruction of everything, as you write in your book, and this is a quote, "Our moment of thought, our instant of light, is at once rare, wondrous, and precious. The fact that we can have this conversation postulating the different ends of the universe, it makes this right now, right here, this is the important thing," right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that in many ways is the ultimate realization that I'm left with and I try to bring to the reader, which is when you think about how incredibly unlikely it is that we are here, that you and I are having this conversation, that Earth exists and so on. When you think about the series of steps that had to unfold, the quantum events from the Big Bang until now, each of these events could have gone this way or that, but they happened to go just the right way so that the particle ingredients that make up me coalesced to yield me, and those that coalesced to make you made you. And that is so fantastically unlikely that it's not only wondrous and beautiful, but for me personally, it fills me with a sense of gratitude for being here, gratitude for being alive, a gratitude for being part of this wondrous universe. And however fleeting our moment may be, and as the book indicates, in the grand scheme of things, it's quite fleeting, but however fleeting it is, it leaves you with a sense of deep awe, reverence, and gratitude for the period that we are given. And to me, that fills me with a sense of respect and reverence for the moment that the universe has given us leave to inhabit.
I left the book feeling like, why waste any time doing something or nothing when you can make an important contribution to what we're doing and just be amazed at what we're thinking about, what you could possibly do. And again, it's like that idea that you only have a year left in your life. Live your life like that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
There's one more quote before I end, and it's from your book. By the grace of random chance funneled through nature's laws, we are here, and that's the amazing thing.
Yep. Yep. That summarizes the whole sequence that allows us to be here. You know, there's nothing but particles and nature's laws, and amazingly, that's enough. Given enough time for us to be here, even for just a moment, but it's enough to get us here and give us the opportunity to do what we want to do with the moment that we're given.
My guest tonight has been Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics and director of Columbia University's Center for Theoretical Physics. We've been talking about his latest book. And by the way, we have only barely scratched the surface of this book. There's a lot in there. Just the chapters on consciousness alone. Until the end of time, mind, matter, and our search for meaning in an evolving universe. Brian, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.